Oyez, 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 the Honorable Court of Appeals for the Third District of the State of Texas, City of Austin, is now in session.
Good morning, y'all can be seated. Good morning. Justice Kelly and Triana, and I welcome you to the Third Court of Appeals. It's a pleasure to have both of you here today. Today we've got 0323329CR, State of Texas versus Gant. We've got Ms. Weatherford and Mr. Schulman here before the court. As you know, we are recording this via YouTube today, the recording will be available late today, and it'll be open to the world to observe even now as you're presenting. As you know, we've got our light system that's highly technical. Green light means you've got your time, your 20 minutes for the state, and then I'm assuming 15 minutes for Mr. Gant, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal for the state. The yellow means you have 2 minutes left. Start wrapping up, and then red means you're done. So with that, if I could have announcements of ready and introductions. Yes.
Good morning. My name is Holly Weatherford, and I'm for the state, and I'm ready.
All right. Thank you.
David Schulman for the defense, and we're ready to proceed.
All right. Thank you. With that, Ms. Weatherford, you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. The state has presented one issue in this case, that the trial court abused its discretion when it granted the appellee's motion for new trial. The appellee's motion raised two issues, that the verdict was contrary to the law and the evidence, which is a sufficiency challenge, and that the verdict was excessive. The trial court raised its own issue, ineffective assistance of counsel, or IAC. And first, I'd like to discuss that the trial court had no authority to grant the motion for new trial based on ineffective assistance. After that, I'd like to discuss how the trial court also abused its discretion if it did grant the motion for new trial based on the issues that the appellee did raise that I just talked about.
Well, let me pivot you right at the front. The trial judge said, if I grant this motion for new trial, I don't have to articulate why, and you disagreed. So what does the case law say about that? What does the trial court have to say or not say?
I don't have case law with me right now regarding whether he has to state what it is that he was granting it on.
Okay.
The trial court in this case purported to grant it on the issue of ineffective assistance. Our argument is that he had no authority to do that, of course, and then if for some reason we say, well, we can look at what the appellee did raise, we still believe that the he still abused his discretion if he would have granted them on those issues.
So if the trial judge had never said anything about ineffective assistance of counsel and just walked in and said, I'm granting a new trial, where would we be? If we took out that part of the transcript where he talks about why he's granting it. And it's okay if you don't know, but I'm just curious what the state's thoughts are on that.
So if he hadn't talked about ineffective assistance of counsel, I still don't think that the state's position is that the appellee didn't meet their burden.
Okay.
As far as the issues that they did raise. They stated in a pretty general one-sentence motion for new trial that they were raising the issues of the sufficiency and the excessive verdict. Our position is that didn't preserve the issue. And further than that, they didn't bring anything at the motion for new trial to support it because those issues weren't even discussed.
So under Arizmendi, what would have had to happen at the hearing to grant relief, I guess is my question.
Well, As far as the appellee's motion, they should have pled it more sufficiently. The state's position is they didn't provide enough notice for us to prepare a rebutting argument at the trial, especially with the trial court raising their own issue. We just didn't have notice, and the state actually did let the trial court know that they had controlling case law to let the trial court know that they couldn't do that, or that it couldn't do that. And the trial judge didn't really let that be known or be said by the state. So,
well, there's a little exchange, I think, between the state, right, and Mr. Shulman about, I have cases, and Mr. Shulman said, they're not relevant to what we're talking about here. And then that sort of, we don't know what the cases were, because it's not in the record what the cases were that were being argued about. But
right.
Okay.
I have a question. So Rule 21.9 says a court must grant a new trial when it has found a meritorious ground for a new trial. So it doesn't make any mention of the ground having to be raised in a motion for a new trial. The trial court found a meritorious ground here. Why doesn't Rule 21.9 give the trial court the authority to grant a new trial based on that ground, even if the defense had brought it up in their motion?
Well, our position is that the controlling case law from the Court of Criminal Appeals states that, well, first of all, a trial court has no authority to grant a motion for a new trial on its own motion. It has to be raised by the defense in a timely motion. And not only that, the Court of Criminal Appeals, I believe it's the Zalman case, states that you have to set forth in the motion for new trial what it is that you're asking relief based on. And so the state's position is that the Court of Criminal Appeals has kind of parsed this issue out already and said the state must have notice. I think notice is really important, and with the court granting it on an issue that he just raises itself, the state has no notice to prepare.
Hypothetically speaking, if the court sends out a letter to both sides and says, I think that there was an effective assistant of counsel, I'd like to have a hearing 20 days from now, show up and tell me, argue, would that then the notice be taken care of? And at that time then, would that have been okay for the trial judge to do?
I'm not sure. I don't, that would be something.
There's a notice issue. I agree with you. There's mm-hmm. a notice issue. But I guess what I want to find out is what's the state's position if there had been notice, not from the defendant, not in the motion for a new trial, but if a trial judge does think that there was, you know, some ineffective assistant counsel, can the judge do anything short of saying, excuse me, Mr. Defendant, you might want to file a motion for a new trial claiming that there's an efficient assistant of counsel?
Like I said, I don't have like case law on point for that. That's something that I would have to look at and maybe submit some authorities on at a later time. But I think based on the case law that we do have, the court is not able to do that.
Okay. And let me ask you one question about error preservation. Is this a situation of that? Do you believe the state had not objected that what the trial court did was fine?
Judge, I didn't hear the last part of your question. Sorry, I have an ear infection, so I can't hear out of one half of my head.
Sorry. I don't know if this helps or not, but my question is, are we talking about a rule of error preservation if the state had not objected to the trial court deciding this on ineffective assistant of counsel? Could the trial court go ahead and find an effective assistant of counsel and grant a new trial if there was not an objection? So if y'all didn't object at the time, at this point, would error preservation, it's like you didn't object, you lose that?
Hypothetically.
Hypothetically.
Correct.
As you know, the state did object. However, with the trial judge granting that at the motion for new trial or raising that issue, there's still no opportunity for trial counsel to give his reasons as to why he made his choices during the trial. So I still think the appellee wouldn't be able to reach their burden under Strickland. That first prong, when there's a silent record, you can't meet that first prong because we don't know what the trial counsel's reasoning was for whatever he did. And in this case, we do have a silent record because not only did the trial court not say why he thought there was ineffective assistance, appellee didn't talk about or didn't put on the record what he thought maybe was some deficient performance or prejudice that he felt there was. That wasn't put on the record either.
So counsel, in practicality, you've got trial counsel at the motion for a new trial. Same trial counsel that tried the case. So it's the state's
different trial.
But let's assume for the moment, motion for new trial, same trial counsel is at the motion for new trial. So is it the state's position that that trial counsel at motion for new trial has to admit on a record, I was ineffective, and I have to put it in writing that I was ineffective at trial, and that's the only way that the trial counsel, it's the same at a motion for new trial, gets to raise that issue, saying I did a bad job, and is that really realistic?
I think that is the only way that would happen. I mean, a lot of times there's reasons why, as you know, trial counsel would make decisions. They have different motivations for objecting, not objecting, doing the different things that they do. So, I mean, I guess hypothetically, but here we don't have that, so we don't know.
So can't a trial judge sua sponte declare a mistrial for a manifest necessity?
I'm unsure of that.
Okay. But they can, and so that's my question was like, how is this functionally different, right, than that at the end of the day? Like, aren't those things sort of functionally equivalent, a trial judge sua sponte granting a motion for new trial? I think what a lot of our questions have focused on is if the trial judge, let's assume the trial judge watches the trial and he observes all the things, you know, that he needs to see in order to find somebody ineffective. Well, what can the trial judge do about that at the end of the day, right? If a trial judge's duty is to make sure that justice is being done, make sure that there's a fair verdict, all those things, what does a trial judge have to do in order to raise, what can they do? And is the state's position nothing, they can't do anything, or?
Well, I don't think that the state's position is that the trial judge doesn't have the authority to do that. It's the defendant's burden. And when we have case law from Court of Criminal Appeals that tells us, especially for something like ineffective assistance, that it's the defendant's burden or their trial counsel's burden to raise that. And that just didn't happen here.
And again, that means that the trial counsel has to say, I did a crappy job, right? I mean, because the defendant is probably not a lawyer. So Mr. Gant, if he doesn't have a law license, looking there at his legal counsel trying a case, and his trial counsel's doing a crappy job, how does Mr. Gant know that he's got a burden to say, my lawyer did a crappy job? What is the state's thoughts on that? I mean, how does a defendant protect themselves from a lawyer with a law license that does a crappy job for them, if they do?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess they're bound by their attorney.
Okay, so officers of the court, they're bound to,
yes,
raise that issue and worry about their malpractice premiums later, or their law license.
Okay. All right, if y'all don't have any other questions, I'll reserve my time for rebuttal.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Schulman.
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning,
Good
and may
morning.
It please the court, Ms. Weatherford. I will readily admit this is one of the most bizarre cases in which I've ever been involved. But I would.
A lot.
Ma'am?
And Mr. Schulman, I really appreciate your comment on page 9 that Judge Devlin believed, based on his experience, that he had to take this highly unusual action.
Yes.
Cannot be dismissed. I don't know that I've ever seen highly unusual stated in an appellee's brief about the judge's action.
Well, and I think we've said it out there, the facts in this case are quite unusual in that the motion for new trial is just generic. It was only intended to buy time for the court reporter to be able to easily produce the record, because we don't have the record, right? And we didn't have any idea what the issues would be at the time, and there was no inkling until just before we had the motion for a new trial hearing when I got a call from the coordinator who said, the judge thinks the lawyer was ineffective, he's going to have a hearing. And I was like, what? So that's where we started.
Well, then if I guess the elephant in the room is if you receive, taking aside the propriety of the phone call,
yes.
If you receive that phone call, then why not amend your motion
to
allege ineffective assistance of counsel before the hearing? Because weren't you within the 30-day window at that point?
I don't remember, Judge.
You could have amended it at that point.
Well, not really. Here's why. This was Mr. Jesutu was appointed, but he was going on vacation. And we knew there was nothing going on, and we happened to have a lull in our practice, which is quite unusual. So he went to Hawaii, and I decided to go to New York. And that's when I got the phone call. And I was not able to do anything. But I think the more important thing is I didn't have a record. And what I would suggest is that even if I had stuck in there, the amended motion, trial of counsel was ineffective, I wouldn't have any basis to say that to back it up. But let me also say, this is not a silent record.
Well, before we get to if you're talking about the record of the trial, before we get there, I mean, how do you get from under this rule in Zalman and Arizmendi that you have to raise the issue in the motion? I mean, we all agree it's not raised in the motion, and we are an intermediate appellate court. We have to do what the Court of Criminal Appeals tells
yes.
us, and the Court of Criminal Appeals has said that's the rule. So
that is
how
the
do you
rule.
How do you get out from under that?
Well, you broached the subject yourself, Judge Justice, that the judge can declare a mistrial sua sponte at any time. And the Court of Criminal Appeals has said on numerous occasions that granting a mistrial is the same as granting a new trial. And in fact, as I think you know, Jesuit and I write summaries for lawyers, and we have them categorized. And when they did that, we changed it so it was now mistrials or new trials are one subject. So the judge could have done everything he did had he declared it a mistrial. And you may look at it that way because the court upstairs has said that's the same thing. Granting a mistrial, granting a new trial is the same thing.
Right, but the court upstairs or across the street, right, has
right.
also said in the motion for new trial, you either have to plead it,
right.
the state has to acquiesce, or the state has to acquiesce to it,
right.
essentially. And neither of those things happen. As a threshold issue, before we get to anything involving sufficiency,
mm-hmm.
so... Is it your request then that we publish an opinion that says these cases are distinguishable because the court never considered that a mistrial is the functional equivalent of a motion for a new trial? I mean, if you were to write the opinion,
yes.
what would it say?
I would be very comfortable with your suggestions, put it that way. I think the court has said on numerous occasions that these are the same, they have the same effect.
They may have the same
yes.
the same effect, though, is a different question than how do you get there. And I think that's what we're struggling with, because we have binding case law that says here are the requirements, and we all agree the requirements haven't been met.
Well, and the, you know, to me, the problem is the notice issue, which is, I mean, we can sit here and argue what does a trial judge, as a former trial judge, that's what I want to know. Okay, so if this happens, what is the proper way to handle
state,
it?
Excuse me.
But the notice is that, and I think that those cases, the problem is on a motion for new trial, we're wanting to give the other side notice of what it is you need to come prepared to argue. And, you know, I'll be asking Ms. Weatherford whether she got the same phone call, her office got the same phone call from the judge's clerk or assistant, giving them a heads up on what the judge was thinking. Because then a question on notice might be a little bit different in my mind. But all the case law says you've got to know the reason why it needs to be in, you know, it's not like any other reason, whatever reason you want to, the judge can go ahead and order a new trial, is because we expect both sides to have notice of what it is they're going to be arguing.
Well, I'm confident the state had exactly the same notice that I had, whether it was a phone call from the coordinator or not, because as the record reflects, they were prepared to offer case law to the judge to say why he couldn't do what he was going to do. So, admittedly, neither side had much notice. And I really think it does come down to, can the trial judge do this on his own, number one, and number two, does the record support his decision?
Because if we rule for you, how could the state ever be prepared for a motion for a new trial? Couldn't the defense always do a bait and switch, maybe even purposely, right? Plead one thing and then show up and offer proof on another thing?
I would suggest that would be fairly far-fetched because, again, the phone call from the coordinator, very unusual. And I have appeared in front of many judges many times who wouldn't let me put on stuff that I wanted to put on because all sorts of reasons. I believe you have to look at this case as sui generis. There is no case like this that I have found, that we could find. The issue, the state is raising the correct issue. Can the judge do this? I would suggest the judge can do this because the judge could have granted a mistrial.
Well, and that's something that you didn't brief at all in your responsive brief.
That's correct. But the other thing is, like you say, it's not a silent record. And if the court will allow me, we pointed out three or four events during the trial that we thought were deficient conduct. But Mr. Jones admitted deficient conduct. And I don't know what page it is in mine, but at one point in the trial, he was discussing Stahmann, which is a case out of New Braunfels, where the court found the evidence insufficient on a tampering with evidence case. And Mr. Jones argued Stahmann, and this controls the case. But not only was he not aware of Arevalo, which we cite, which in my opinion extremely restricts the effect of Stahmann on those types of cases, but he also said on the record, I have not had a chance to do any research on this particular area.
So is it your theory, and Arevalo is a sex assault case from 1998, if somebody said Arevalo, I don't know that I would know that off the top of my head either, but do you mean he's ineffective because he was unaware of how to get a lesser included or unaware that he was not entitled to a lesser included here?
Neither. I would say he was ineffective based on his admission that he hadn't had a chance to do any research in the area. Well, I mean, we're not talking about, I might have made that argument, had 4 days, 5 days, but Jones was trial counsel. This is not a trial where they indicted the guy and went to trial a week later. There is absolutely no excuse for a lawyer to not have researched the issues in the case, and certainly if he knows about Stahmann and he hasn't done any research, I mean, somebody told him, hey, you got to argue this.
But isn't isn't the effect of Arevalo that he would not have received the lesser included? So,
Your Honor, I only included that because, to me, that's an admission of deficient conduct. That when you tell the court, I haven't done what I'm supposed to have done, you have admitted deficient conduct. The real issue in this case would then become, what's the harm? There is a case from the Court of Criminal Appeals, which I believe is called Menchak, that I will update. in which the lawyers made the statement that I stood to object, but I didn't know what the objection was. And it's the same type of thing. Well, you know there's an objection, but you don't know what it is. You're not prepared.
Is it the same if your argument is that the case forecloses the lesser included offense? Like he didn't know about the case that foreclosed the thing he was asking for? I mean, how does that change the end delta of whether or not you get the lesser included offense?
I honestly do not think that is the issue. The issue is that he admitted he had done no research.
Okay. So your position is anytime an attorney admits that they have not done research in an area, that is per se ineffective?
That term per se is always alluded to. But I would say this, Judge. Where an issue is important enough for the lawyer to raise it, it's important enough to have done the research. Are you entitled to a lesser included, or can the state do this, or the defense do this? The point is, one of the duties of trial counsel is to be prepared on the facts and the law, to have researched the facts and the law. And this is an admission that he had not researched the case well enough. I also think, like I said, we point out three different incidents during the trial where I would assert that as defense counsel, he should have objected.
I know hearsay was one of the areas. Aren't most of those statements something that could have been admissible as effect on the listener to explain why the police officers did certain things at the scene? You said you cited several examples of hearsay from police officers.
There, where he should have objected or done something. But I think that he has made an admission, and the judge certainly said that he's talking about his 44 years on the bench, and he believes there's ineffective assistance, and as a result, justice has not prevailed for Mr. Gant. That is Strickland. He told us, unfortunately, most lawyers and judges, when they say ineffective assistance, what they're talking about is deficient conduct, because you still have to prove the harm under the second prong. But I think the judge is telling us there, he wasn't any good, and justice has not prevailed for Mr. Gant. Well, that's what Strickland 2 is about. Does it undermine confidence in the verdict? And I would say Judge Devlin's comments show that the performance undermined his confidence in the verdict.
If we don't agree with you in this appeal and he was in fact ineffective, what can be done about it then?
Well, that's what I was going to argue this down later about judicial economy. The next step would be an Article 1107 habeas corpus application, which would go back to Judge Devlin or someone else, and Devlin could be a witness, but the point is, if that happened, it went back to Judge Devlin, what do you think his ruling would be?
Well, and Judge Devlin, is he a visiting judge?
He was a visiting judge.
So I guess that's a question. What should it go back to Judge Devlin? I mean, what's your position on that? Or does it just go
it
back
goes,
to Comal County? And
yes, it goes back, and there is no provision that the visiting judge has to sit. It is up to the trial court judge.
But it could go back for a writ hearing and to reach the same result.
Yes. And the one other thing that I would like the court to explore, and the truth is I can't find any case law to help you. Clearly there was a motion for new trial that wouldn't qualify under Reyes to entitle us to a hearing on the facts. Nevertheless, there was, and the judge announced what his decision would be, et cetera. But what it seems to me is whether he was right or wrong, what he truly believed, we really don't know. And I would suggest the court should explore the possibility of remanding it for him to make findings. That would provide the court with evidence.
So we would remand it for findings on the motion for new trial?
Abate and remand on for the trial judge to make findings as to why he believed the defendant.
But didn't the state ask for findings of facts and conclusions of law, and he didn't do that?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And I asked him. And he told them, well, he doesn't have to do that. So, I mean, The state asked for it first, I believe, and I tried to encourage him to do something. Put it on the record. Tell us what you think. Because I knew this would be a problem. I am not a baby in the woods. But he did not want to, declined to, for reasons I don't know. But I believe the trial court could have, and I believe that because the motion for a new trial, whatever it was timely. The state objected to wanted findings. The defense wanted findings. I don't see why this court cannot remand for findings. The same it could do it in other cases.
But okay. And what findings do you think the judge could do to support?
To set out his reasons for granting the motion for a new trial, within the guidelines set by Strickland. I mean.
However, then you still have the Court of Criminal Appeals saying it wasn't in the motion, so the state didn't get notice.
Correct.
So it wasn't fair to the state to go to a motion for a new trial hearing without notice.
Absolutely. And that's why I say the court should explore it.
Because shouldn't we have given the state the opportunity to go to Mr. Jones and get an affidavit from Mr. Jones to explain this, you know, his Aravella research or non-research and his objections and his performance in court?
I don't see why. Do I think this court can? The only guidelines I have is what the Court of Criminal Appeals does in similar situations in habeas, and their remands always instruct the trial court to do this and says the trial court may, for example, order affidavits, etc.
But my point is, if we go back, if we remand and just give the judge the opportunity to list his reasons, still the state has never, to the chief's point, the state's never been able to be heard. Versus if you have an 1107 hearing, I'm assuming they're going to go prepare for it and talk
yes.
to Mr. Jones and present evidence to try to
well,
rebut what might be presented during that hearing.
I do think it would not be correct for this court to remand the case for findings without allowing input from the state, from other witnesses. But let me put it this way. I don't believe that there would be any reason that on remand, if there is one, the state couldn't immediately go get Mr. Jones's affidavit and submit it to the trial court. I am not here to say that the case law gives you any guidance at all, because I think it does not. I have been told since day two or three in law school, you know, the bad facts make bad law, and I've always considered bad lawyering makes more bad law. And although the lawyers involved didn't do anything wrong, I think the judge could have taken one or two steps that would have made this whole thing much easier.
Calling for a mistrial.
Ma'am?
Calling for a mistrial, is that what you mean?
Yes. Well, I think there are more problems in this case than are apparent at this point, but that's the starting point, is he was determined to grant a new trial and wouldn't tell the parties on the record why. And, I mean, it's our job to come up with some reasons, and we did, but I would have liked a more clear record myself.
I'm confident Justice Triana is about to ask the state about notice. So one question I have is, you know, you put in your brief that the court coordinator called your office.
Yes.
And said this. That's not in the hearing.
Nope.
No one talks about that. Is that something that we can or should even consider since it's not part of the record?
I also think it's really not part of the issue. The point is whether I knew about it or not, or the state knew about it or not, the real issue is the trial court's actions. And it was why the coordinator called me, I don't know. I can tell you I was in a boat on a lake in New York when I got it. And I was saying, but all that aside, everything the state says is a valid argument. And you guys get the great job of having to decide what it is. But beyond that, I just don't know. And it's like, I've had many cases where, damn, I wish I'd written that opinion, but this isn't one of them. If there are no other questions, I'll give
Thank
the court
you,
back
counsel.
35 seconds.
Thank you
for your
so
time.
Thank you so much, counsel. Yes, let me hear from the state.
Thank you.
All right. So Mr. Shulman just asked, you know, or just said the real issue is what the trial court did. And here the trial court had no authority to do what he did. He mentioned two questions. Can the trial court do it on his own? State's position is that he cannot do that. And he also mentioned, does the record support it? No. So,
what's your position on his suggestion that we remand for findings of fact and conclusions of law?
I don't believe that it's appropriate. I think for the reasons that the court has already stated, the appellee asked for a new trial in this case. They waived the issue of ineffective assistance by not pleading it in there, and the trial court granting it was inappropriate. So we think that you should reverse because of that, reverse his order because of that.
And so I'm going to go ahead and ask, because I said I was going to ask. So do you know, Ms. Weatherford, was your office also told that the judge had issues, he wanted to have a hearing because he believed that there was an effective assistant of counsel?
And I apologize, but I actually do not know. I was not involved in the case at the trial level, and I didn't write the brief in this case, so I'm sorry I don't have an answer for that.
Do you agree that this could be the subject of a post-trial writ, and we may end up getting to the same result?
I'm unsure about that. I just know that, you know, here the case law and the evidence supports that the trial court erred if he granted it based on ineffective assistance. And he also abused his discretion if he granted it on the other issues that the appellee did raise in their motion for new trial, because there just wasn't, or there was actually, I'm sorry, legally sufficient evidence to support the outcome of the case.
But we could affirm his ruling. We could affirm his ruling based on sufficiency. So I guess that then going to the merits, is this really tampering, right? Just because it's night out and it took a flashlight to find this cigarillo, you know, blunt that was never tested, and there was, it is, should whether it's a crime on tampering matter if it's daytime or nighttime when you're throwing something out the window, like?
Well, Mr. Shulman mentioned the Stallman case, and in that case, I believe there was, the defendant got into a car accident
through
and
the pill bottle.
Yes, through the pill bottles. The witnesses saw it, officers saw it, and they said there's no concealment because it wasn't in view at all times. Our position is that that case supports our case here as far as concealment, because here the facts are different. It was nighttime versus daytime in Stallman. We had a couple officers that looked for the marijuana cigarillo and couldn't find it. When the original officer went to go look for the marijuana cigarillo, he had to use a flashlight to look for it because it was so dark outside, and I believe the area was on I-35. It was poorly lit. There were cars going by really fast. So Stallman does support that there was concealment in our case.
But the cigarette was never tested, right? Something was recovered and it was never tested.
I believe it was, Your
Honor.
I
thought it was tested.
Well, there was a field test, but the results of the field test were not in the record.
I don't believe the results of the field test are in the record, but it was tested for for marijuana.
Okay.
Yes.
But there's some testimony that says, without revealing the results, did you test this? And I could not find where they said what the results were of the testing.
I believe that was just the field test, yes. Yeah. And since I have a little bit of time, I'll also mention that it wouldn't be only under concealment that we would meet, he also altered the crime scene in this case, and so the jury could have found it on either theory there. And so, again, our position is that the trial court, if he did grant it on those other issues, he abused his discretion, because if you're looking at the combined and cumulative force of the evidence, and giving weight to the jury's verdict in this case, the evidence was legally sufficient. And the state would just respectfully request that this court reverse the trial court's order and affirm the jury's unanimous verdict. And if y'all don't have any other questions, then
thank you both. And the court will stand in recess, and this case will be submitted. Thank you so much. All right.
All rise.